from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today I'm pleased to announce my nominee to be our next Secretary of Defense, Mr. Ash Carter. Now, with a record of service that has spanned more than 30 years, as a public servant, as an advisor, as a scholar, Ash is rightly regarded as one of our nation's foremost national security leaders.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama Friday announcing his choice for a new Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, who replaces the outgoing Chuck Hagel.
As a top member of our Pentagon team for the first 5 years of my presidency, including his 2 years as Deputy Secretary, he was at the table in the Situation Room. He is by my side navigating complex security challenges that we were confronting. I relied on his expertise, and I relied on his judgment. I think it's fair to say that, Ash, in your one-year attempt at retirement from public service, you failed miserably.
Carter previously worked at the Pentagon during the Clinton administration and returned during the Bush and Obama administrations. He worked under former Secretary Robert Gates and served as the senior deputy defense secretary under both Leon Panetta and Hagel. According to former Clinton Defense Secretary William J. Perry, one of the mentors Carter cited Friday, the new secretary, quote, is pretty hard-nosed about what can be done with American power, and he is willing to use it when appropriate, closed quote. Perry was the architect of plans that led to both the post-Soviet expansion of NATO into East Europe, as well as the U.S.-led war against Yugoslavia. Perry and Carter co-authored an important paper on U.S. geopolitical strategy in 1999, entitled Preventive Defense, A New Security Strategy for America. Andrew Korybko is a political analyst and journalist specializing in Russian affairs and geopolitics. His particular area of expertise is U.S. strategy in Eurasia. We spoke with him Friday. I was particularly interested in your piece about the new Secretary of Defense, particularly the part that deals with his history, and particularly the part of his history as a co-author of the publication in 1999, Preventative Defense, A New Security Strategy for America. Do you want to talk about that a little bit and what it means perhaps for relations between the U.S. and the rest of the world going forward?
Yeah, this is actually a very important piece. At the time, it was somewhat revolutionary, if you will, because he preached the doctrine that the United States can enforce its power across the world without necessarily using military force. And he tried to identify a couple of future problems for the United States, which turn out to be, in terms of foreign policy right now, somewhat prescient the way things turn out. One of the things he identified was what he called Weimar Russia, which he saw as he tried to create this silly analogy of Russia being like the Weimar Republic, therefore with all the Nazi inferences afterwards and whatnot. Another scenario was a rising China turned hostile. We see that reflected in the U.S.'s paranoia of China and catastrophic terrorism. We all know the history about how terrorism has developed in the modern age, unfortunately. And one of the reasons why this is so important is because it's basically – it turned out to be the American blueprint. Even before Ashton Carter was nominated as Secretary of Defense, even before people were even considering him, in this work is when he first really started toying with the idea of the pivot to Asia. So with that, we see right now that this has become one of the main staples of American foreign policy since 2011, back when Clinton was still Secretary of State. So you see this continuity that's going forward is becoming more important, more impactful in American foreign policy, and this is the architect. And what makes him so strategic, if you will, is because I mentioned that he says America's will can be enforced through non-military means, but when it comes to military means as well, he wasn't just talking about full-blown invasions like Iraq or Afghanistan. He was also talking about surgical strikes, and this was reflected back in 2006. Back when he was at the Pentagon at that time, he was heavily arguing for a strategic strike, as he was calling it, against North Korea when they wanted to test a satellite. And we see a couple months after that, they exploded their first one of their they exploded a nuclear device. So what makes it interesting is if America would have had a surgical strike, and if North Korea was really as unpredictable as the media says they are, which is, of course, subject to debate, it really doesn't take a genius to guess how North Korea may have responded, and America might not have even known about that. So Ashton Carter is really important for America's strategy, but it may not be for the right reasons.
You know, and he co-authored that piece with Perry, who was in the Clinton administration and who was one of the architects of the expansion of NATO and of the U.S., you know, the breaking up of Yugoslavia and the entire mess that went on there, including NATO bombings.
Yeah, and actually, it's interesting you mentioned NATO, because something else I wanted to mention is Ashton Carter from 93 to 96, right in the time frame of the breakup of Yugoslavia and right in the middle of the Dayton Accords, he was Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, which is really important because his focus was on Europe, Middle East, and Africa. And specifically within this framework, he was also working with multilateral organizations, specifically NATO. Now, looking at his NATO experience, and we all see how NATO had its first war with Yugoslavia at the time, we can almost see a vision of the future for how he's going to act with Asia. Going back to the pivot, more than likely, he may try to copy and replicate this multilateral framework into East and Southeast Asia. One of the ideas that I have, my assessment is that Carter may be trying to strengthen the United States alliance system in East Asia, expand into Southeast Asia, and what that means for the average American is more foreign entanglements and more mutual defense treaties, which can unnecessarily draw the United States into a war over what may very well be a couple small islands and rocks in the South China Sea.
You know, you see the Obama administration having encouraged the overt remilitarization of Japan. I mean, it's been taking place incrementally for years, but in recent years, there's been an actual overt move towards that. How do you see that fitting into the strategy in Asia?
Well, I see it as a type of strategy of tension, and Japan has previously been called America's unsinkable aircraft carrier, if you will. And as you mentioned, this strategy of Japanese remilitarization has been going on for some time, but it's been heavily accelerated under the Obama administration. And this is really important because it's not just with Japan versus China. There's also Japan versus Russia, theoretically, over the Kuril Islands dispute, the World War II era problem that hasn't been going away. Basically, in my analysis, it is the world's longest frozen conflict. Why this is important is because Japan has a huge economy, but Japan has a dying population. Japan also doesn't have any natural resources. One would think that if there wasn't any there weren't any politics involved, Japan would be a natural partner for Russia to cooperate. Russia gets investment, Japan gets natural resources. But this Kuril Islands dispute is holding things up. So that's one thing. Now, the other thing that is lost on some people, because it's a relatively minor issue but with very strong implications, is the island dispute between South Korea and Japan over a small rock right between the two in the Sea of Japan. And why this is important is Japan is also an American ally with mutual defense, but Japan has a very negative World War II history because of the Japanese occupation, slaughtering, and indentured forced sexual servitude of women. So with that being said, it's very tricky for the U.S. to manage relations between the two and get them on the same page, specifically against China. One interesting after effect of this rock dispute between South Korea and Japan is it's driving a wedge between two of America's allies. So that's one thing that in the long term, if Japanese remilitarization starts getting even more out of control, and I don't see why it wouldn't, it seems that this is going to be proceeding full speed ahead, what can happen is South Korea may actually pivot towards China because it might be too much pressure from Japan. And that would create a very interesting dynamic of having, you know, American troops in South Korea, but South Korea is not really siding with the United States. It'd be very similar to what we're seeing with Turkey today moving towards Russia.
Yeah, that's an interesting, triangulation, I guess. You have first the history of Japan in both Korea and China in World War II, and there's very strong national sentiment towards Japan in each of those two places over that history. And you have the dynamic of North and South Korea and you know, their relations as things develop. And China just signed some major trade agreements with South Korea. You know, with that happening, how will the United States manage all of that, given the complexities of it and given some of the natural tendencies that should be manifest, like you described, perhaps between Japan and Russia?
Well, OK, I have a couple forecasts for how I see things developing. I see At first, what I think is clear to many people is that there's a huge information war going on. There's a lot of propaganda that's being directed against Russia, although there is propaganda and intense information warfare directed against China. I see the lessons that the United States is learning and refining in its soft war against the against Russia being used against China, because one of the greatest consequences of American aggression lately, especially in the 21st century, has been Russia and China have gotten together and they're very, very close friends. So the lessons that are applied towards one will also be used towards the other. Now, looking at that paradigm, we can see an intensification of information warfare against China, a demonization against China, and just as the U.S. is trying to do in Eastern and Central Europe, trying to create a type of security belt, if you will, of states that they truly believe, their political leadership truly believes in their best interest to counter their larger neighbor, even if it may not be in their best interest. A lot of this is because the United States has influence over many elites in Eastern Asia. Now, moving towards Southeastern Asia, if we're going to look there towards the ASEAN countries, Philippines and Vietnam, for example, Vietnam is behaving more pragmatically. It's a big question mark whether or not they would latch on to any type of alliance with or without direct American participation. One thing that could possibly happen is a maritime alliance between Vietnam and the Philippines to support one another in case there is a war with China. But if that happens, that's already an unstable alliance right there. But the interesting part is that would draw the United States into the conflict through its mutual defense treaty with the Philippines. So that's basically a hidden shadow way to make the Vietnam and the United States mutual security partners through the Philippines.
Andrew Karibko, thank you for your time.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Shut the whole system down! Shut the whole system down!
That was the sound of one of many protests that spread around the country Thursday after news that the grand jury hearing the case in the homicide of Eric Garner returned no indictment. Thousands gathered and marched across New York City, where protesters again chanted Eric Garner's last words. Multiple groups of protesters marched throughout Manhattan, closing lanes on the Brooklyn Bridge, on the West Side Highway, and at the Lincoln and Holland Tunnels. Protesters also targeted the Staten Island Ferry. In Brooklyn, they staged a die-in and laid down next to coffins inscribed with the names of victims of fatal police shootings. Police said there were dozens arrested, but did not provide further details. Newark, New Jersey also saw a large mobilization Thursday.
Police brutality
in the black community!
Police brutality
in the black community!
Thousands also filled the streets in Boston, Washington, D.C., Orlando, Dallas, Chicago, Los Angeles, and the Bay Area in California. In Boston, thousands of protesters gathered in Boston Common and fanned out across the city, blocking traffic and interrupting transit service. There were also large crowds outside the State House and City Hall Plaza and on the Charleston Bridge. At least 10 protesters were arrested, according to police. In the nation's capital, protesters gathered in front of the Justice Department at 4 p.m., and began a march that took them near the national Christmas tree lighting at the Ellipse, where attendees reportedly heard their chants. Protests continued in downtown Washington Thursday night, with demonstrators standing on 14th Street Bridge and closing it temporarily. Police said that after leaving the bridge, the protesters marched west on Constitution Avenue, causing street closures as they moved. In Orlando, Florida, protesters gathered at 5 p.m. at the corner of East Colonial Drive and Magnolia Avenue, and shut down the intersection before police reopened it. No arrests were reported there. In Dallas, protesters filled Dealey Square, the site of the assassination of President John Kennedy. Others tried to shut down I-35. Several people were detained Thursday, although reports were unclear as to whether they were arrested. In Chicago, protesters shut down Lakeshore Drive, and there were protests in L.A. and throughout the Bay Area in California, and in Phoenix, where unarmed Romain Brisbane, who was delivering dinner to his family Tuesday night when a police officer shot and killed him, emotions ran high among protesters. Meanwhile, as Cleveland wrestles with the aftermath of the police killing of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, the Justice Department announced Thursday that a nearly two-year civil rights investigation into the police department found a pattern of unreasonable and unnecessary use of force, resulting in dangerous and reckless behavior by officers. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder went to Cleveland to deliver the report personally. Glenn Ford is the executive director of BlackAgendaReport.com. We discussed the situation that's been brewing in Ferguson and in New York City and elsewhere in the United States Friday. This is another in a long history of both chokehold deaths that are unpunished and killings of black men that go unpunished by generally white police officers. Let's start with how exactly we got to this point.
Well, yeah, you know, that basically asks the question, what is this movement or movement in the making all about? Is it about chokeholding of black men? Is it about police shooting of black men? Is it about racial profiling of black folks in their own communities or in non-black communities? Is it about the whole totality of the treatment of black folks by police? And the answer is the latter. It's about all of that. And we can trace this in an institutional way in terms of U.S. domestic policy to the post-civil rights era, to the Black Power era that followed the civil rights era, and the U.S. state's effort to contain these newly somewhat emancipated black folks. And we see the beginnings of what I call the black mass incarceration state about 1970, when we see a real and measurable dramatic increase in incarceration, so that by the early 21st century, the prison population had increased sevenfold, and the ratio of non-white to white prison inmates had reversed itself. That is, before 1965, about 70% of U.S. prison inmates were white. By the late 90s, the ratio had been reversed, and 70% of U.S. prisoners were black and brown. And one out of every eight of the inmates on planet Earth were African American. So we see that this is a growing, developing U.S. domestic policy to contain the entire black population by criminalizing the entire black population. And everything, all of these police abuses flow from that, from U.S. policy of the last 45 years.
And you could consider it an extension of the system of chattel slavery, almost, given that the prohibition in the Constitution contains only one exemption, being, of course, people who are imprisoned or convicted of crimes.
Sure. We have on the streets, in a practical sense, a kind of black codes regime, as was imposed immediately after emancipation. But the black codes were different in that they were black codes. They specifically said that no more than two or three black folks can congregate on a street corner. After the civil rights revolution, that was impermissible. You couldn't say, you couldn't restrict people based upon their race. So you criminalized all of black folks, and you did it under the code and language of criminal justice and law, rather than a strict racial apartheid law. But it has at least as deleterious effect on the population, because you can't, on the face of it, point to race. But the victims know it's about race, and that's what this movement is about, the use of the criminal justice system to oppress a certain category of people, black folks.
And the impacts, when you look at them specifically, you're talking about a population that are in a prison or jail right now of better than 2 million, 2.5 million, and then there's also this legion of other people that are either on probation or parole and under disability in terms of civil rights, legally, again, under the very same constitution that supposedly abolished slavery.
After the Troubles, if we can call them that, like the Irish used to do, after the Troubles broke out in Ferguson, a survey was done, and it was found that in black Ferguson, which is two-thirds of that small city, the average household has three outstanding warrants, almost all of them, of course, for traffic violations. Three outstanding warrants per household. That means in Ferguson and places like that, the police could actually reach out into a crowd with great confidence that anybody they snatched up would have a warrant. And in the United States today, a black person with a warrant is fair game for any treatment that you might want to mete out. In fact, without a warrant, because there is an assumption of criminality.
Wow. Okay, so we have had the media exposure, the media, I'll say coverage, it burst out because then they're covering it because they had to, essentially, because of the magnitude of the response. But we have Ferguson, and now we have Eric Garner. As people were organizing to come out in the streets for Eric Garner, there's another murder in Phoenix that is starting to hit the media because they're looking at these things at the moment.
And, of course, the kid in Cleveland who was shot within 2 seconds of coming under the gaze of a policeman.
A 12-year-old.
Shot because he had a toy pistol.
Mm. Yeah, and so we have a response to all of that in the formation. We have both the official response, if you could call it that, and also the real response, which is the response of the people in the streets. If you could get 5 minutes to lecture the assembled resistance in the country as to what was to be done next, what would you tell them?
Well, the standard list of reforms, and we've been mulling over these same reforms for 40-something years, would have at the top of the list community control of police. By community control, we mean the community that is targeted by the police having the determinant say on police hiring, police firing, and the tactical and strategic uses of the police. That is, the police becoming servants of the community. That's got to be at the top of the list. It's not revolutionary. It is reform. But in a practical sense, it is very unlikely that by judicial or legislative means, this kind of meaningful community reform can be accomplished. As Larry Hamm, who heads up the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey, which I think is the most dynamic and effective black grassroots organization in the country, as he points out, all of these cities are actually creatures of the state. And the kinds of reforms like meaningful community control of police can't be instituted without the cooperation, without the assent of state legislatures. State legislatures that are controlled by reactionary majorities and deeply influenced by the Fraternal Order of Police and such, and simply would not permit the kind of community control that the community needs. So in the long run, and this is my belief, in the long run, I don't think there will be meaningful penetration of this oppressive system until cities are rendered ungovernable. That is, this will be outside of the legal arena, that the pressure from the streets is all that really stands a chance of making a dent in what has become a foundational organizing principle of U.S. governance, and that is the black mass incarceration state.
Yeah, you have the state law governing policing in the municipalities, and so if you were looking for change, you would have to get the legislature and the governor in each case.
And the judiciary as well.
Right, they have to enforce it.
Which has always weighed in on the side of, against rather, residency laws for police and such.
Right, and then you also have the existing structures. You have in New York, for example, an attorney general, who some people call a progressive, who can, under the existing law, walk into any grand jury taking place in New York State. And the moment he walks in, he's in charge of the entire procedure that's ongoing there and can bring his own files to run through that grand jury as well, with him as the conductor or her as the conductor. That hasn't happened, and that's quite possible, and as a matter of fact, that did happen under the current governor's father in one case. So if you have structures that don't respond, and you have political figures that don't respond, and you have a condition where the only way that you're going to get even meaningful reform is by creating alternative structures, how do we go about doing that?
Well, this movement, I think, has embedded within it. You know, this is a movement without a name. And the reason that it has no name is because even the most militant participants are not quite clear about its objectives. But objectively, where it's going is towards a massive popular indictment of the legitimacy of the state. So the arena is already moving because of those factors that you cited to actions and strategies that are beyond legality, if we can call it that. That is the people deciding what the parameters of struggle are. And they make these decisions, which are very hard and very risky, when they come up against the kinds of brick walls that you also described.
What do you think is going to be the response of the state once there is a decision made on what to do next by the people in the street?
It will be a broad and varied and multi-layered response. There are, within the ruling circles, those who would like to bring down the hammer as an example and as an exercise of the muscles that they've been adding furiously, especially since 9/11, to bring that hammer down decisively with a shock and awe effect and crush this stuff before it gets out of hand. That is one of the imperatives that will come from some circles, and especially from the law enforcement circles themselves. But there are other considerations that other sectors of the ruling class have to take into consideration. That is the image of the United States in the world. What kind of imperialism is it? The United States can't do everything that it wants to do domestically or internationally. There are other people and other forces to contend with. We need to be aware of that as well. That is a weakness of the imperial monster, and we need to take advantage of that. It's not going to be a monolith. If it were, then everybody needs to go to the barricades right now, but it's not. And there are options, and there is a flexibility.
When you mention the international response or the international view of what happens in the United States, of course, there is, and you just filed a commentary on this, as a matter of fact, what happened at the Committee Against Torture at the UN in Geneva. In the old period, in the period of the Cold War, the civil rights movement and the repression that had originally overtly been expressed to it created a real problem for the United States vis-a-vis the Soviet Union competing in Africa and Asia and South America. Now that you don't have this ideological divide, but you have a new bloc, an alternative bloc forming, do you see the same kind of dynamic maybe coming into place where the U.S. has to be very careful of international opinion?
Yeah, and in some ways it may be more advantageous to play the image card, if you will, than it was during the Cold War, because the United States does not have recourse to label everyone who criticizes it as being part of, some extension of, an agent of the Warsaw Pact. There is no Warsaw Pact. Russia is certainly not a socialist country anymore. And so the constituency, the audience that we here in the United States can play to is in Europe, it's in China, it's in Latin America, it's in Africa, it's everywhere, and it cannot be labeled as having some kind of ulterior motive that is centered on loyalty to some outside entity.
And do you think, finally, on that point, that recent votes in the United Nations General Assembly on, for example, the sanctions against Cuba and various behaviors displayed by Israel are indicative of public opinion around the world?
Sure. It's indicative of a global consensus that is every day at odds with U.S. Policy.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.